This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Welcome back. This is episode number 23 of the Until the Whistle podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Myers, and it's been a minute. I haven't, I don't think I've talked to you guys since after the third spring practice. So that was earlier this month in April. I'm recording this on Monday, April 29th. Just had a lot going on, honestly, in the last, several weeks. And I didn't even watch the spring game, to be honest. So that's not going to be something that we talk about. And that was part intentional, part, you know, just life happening. I happened to be at a wedding out of the country in the Dominican Republic the weekend of the spring game. So I missed that. And was able to, you know, kind of catch up on some of the highlights of it. Listen to, guys like Anwar's podcast, and some of the reporting that he and even some of the guys over at Orange Bloods did. Generally speaking, it kind of came out as, there wasn't a ton learned, from the spring game. So I never honestly really even felt inclined to go back and watch it. I don't know if that, you know, means that I'm not doing a good job in, the fullness of my air quote coverage of the team. But at least in my experience from the time that I played and then from what I've seen in the years that have gone by since, the spring game is typically, you know, more so for the fans than anything. It is an opportunity, you know, for guys to get a chance to play in front of a crowd. Specifically if that's something that they haven't done before. So a lot of times, you know, a lot of the younger guys get a chance to shine, and it certainly doesn't hurt you by any means if you make some plays in that regard. But I think you've heard Coach Herman refer to it as just another practice. And, by and large, I think if you kind of look at it in the grand scheme of things, typically, they've had around a dozen to 15 practices that take place before the spring game, including scrimmages and ones that are closed to the general public. And so they tend to show a little bit more in those scrimmages. I did have the pleasure of being able to attend two of the scrimmages earlier during spring ball, rather. And so I think I derived a lot from those, scrimmages, as well as the one other practice that I attended. And typically by the time they get to the spring game, things are fairly vanilla. They're not showing a whole lot in the way of formations or blitzes or, you know, anything like that from offensive and defensive perspectives. And it's more, kind of focusing on the fundamentals, making sure that everybody comes out, of the game unscathed, and that, just kind of more of a vanilla approach, because ultimately teams end up having access to that film. They can kind of break it down, do things like that to get a feel for what it is you're trying to do. So if you're looking for me to review the spring game, that won't be happening in this podcast, but there's tons of other great content out there on the Yak that, has covered that game in full. So I'll briefly talk about, just kind of what I think some general consensus is on some top players coming out of the spring players that would be viewed as the top players over the duration of the spring. What I'm going to spend probably a little bit more time on is talking about the 2019 NFL draft, which has just come and went this past weekend or beginning last Thursday. And then I think I'll even dive a little bit into some Avengers Endgame talk and even Game of Thrones, both of which I am fully up to speed on. I saw Avengers Endgame Thursday night last week at 10:50. Now, one of the things about that is this is, effectively a franchise that I've been, immersed in since, 2008 when Iron Man came out. And so just, seeing all the twists and turns that it's taken us has been, certainly a journey and something that, is part of, what I would consider like my cinematic growth, if you will. And Game of Thrones is kind of the same. You know, it's been a series that I've been following for probably over 5 years now. Now, it's certainly been in play since 2011, but I didn't start watching it right away. I don't think I really got into the full swing of it until maybe after season three. So I binged the first three seasons, and then from there on, I was hooked. But, you know, we're up to, you know, what just happened last night, which was Sunday night, and it was the Battle of Winterfell. So I got some thoughts on those, on both of those topics. Depending on how long I talk, I guess, about this draft stuff, I may dive into some of it. And yes, it will involve spoilers. You know, at this point, I feel like if you haven't watched either of them, you know, I understand people have lives and stuff, but ultimately it just wasn't a priority for you. But I will make it a point to let you know, hopefully in the show notes, as well as audibly, when I'm going to get into those spoilers, so that if you haven't watched, at that point, you can kind of cut it off. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, all in all, like I said, life has just been pretty busy for me. Work has been extremely busy as of late. And then just, you know, been trying to kind of, I guess, deal with just, you know, some different aspects of life in general. And so I just haven't had the opportunity to really get in front of the mic and talk to you guys. And I thought, what better, you know, time to do after the NFL draft has come and gone, and we take a look at some of those things. So, like I said, hopping into, you know, some of the standouts from spring ball. Honestly, I think the first thing that I did is I kind of took a look at a list that 24/7 Sports put out, and it was pretty in line with I think what I agreed with in the way of, you know, the top players of, you know, the duration of spring practices. Now, you got to keep in mind, the defense was without several of their starters, that, you know, we expect to be starters and or major contributors in the fall for, you know, different periods, mainly the safeties. So, you know, to recap, Caden Stearns was out. Brandon Jones was out. There was periods of time where Chris Brown was out. When you move to the cornerback situation, you had Anthony Cook out a good portion of spring ball. When you flip over, well, I guess even before moving to the offensive side of the ball, you also had an area of need that we were hoping that Gabriel Floyd would be able to fill. Looks like he's going to miss the entire 2019 season, dealing with a spine condition. You had a portion of the earlier practices where Keandre Coburn was unable to go, but luckily he was able to, you know, come back to full strength. So, you know, you had an opportunity for a lot of guys to get a lot of valuable reps, and I think that's going to be critical, particularly in the way of the secondary, because there's just so many safeties that we have that are extremely talented and versatile. And then you flip over to the offensive side of the ball. Colin Johnson really didn't participate in the majority of team drills and didn't participate in any of the scrimmages, but he's kind of a known quantity. In a lot of instances, they treated Devin Duvernay with some kid gloves and gave him an opportunity to fully recover. You had John Burt fully devoting himself to track. And I think that was it. And then I think even a couple of times when I was out there, Brew McCoy, you know, was in a green jersey. So there was, you know, a couple little things that he was, you know, being limited in, but ultimately was able to get into the swing of things. And so, again, another area where you're able to work in a lot of guys that typically hadn't had as many reps and maybe wouldn't get, you know, the level of reps that they would have received had some of those guys been at full go. And then you also just have a chance to, you know, play with some of the lineups and the formations and things like that. And then you're even going to have another iteration of this when some of the guys arrive this summer that aren't on campus yet. And particularly I'm thinking about the Parker Bronze, the Jake Smiths of the world, even the I think his name is David Benga is how you pronounce his name, but the linebacker that, you know, could potentially come in and get some more time because, you know, that's an area that we're still kind of thin at. So all in all, I think the spring gave a lot of guys an opportunity to step up. And, you know, if I'm honest, you know, like I said, I was taking a look at this list that 24/7 Sports put out of kind of like the top 10-ish players. And really, from what I saw, I think more than anything, I was just glad that, you know, by and large, these 10 guys were the ones that kind of walked away, that you came away from practice being, came away from that, you know, what, 4 weeks of spring practice being impressed by. But I don't think any of them honestly were true shocks for me. And so, like I said, I had an opportunity to go to 2 scrimmages and a practice. And these all were the guys that I would have picked. You know, I think generally speaking, the consensus of everybody that's been able to attend some of the practices are these are kind of the guys that impress most. And so I think if anything, it was just, you know, guys taking advantage of opportunities and, you know, in some respects, living up to their billing. And so I think the top 3 that, you know, really stood out specifically, you know, to me. And this is in no particular order, but from the offensive side of the ball were Jordan Whittington, Keontae Ingram, and Malcolm Epps. Whittington being the you know, all world recruit coming in, and you know, getting his first time on the 40 acres here in starting in January. Now, keep in mind, this guy's still supposed to be in high school, but I mean, every time I saw him touch the ball, whether it was through a traditional you know, handoff out of the backfield, or, you know, in the passing game, he was making plays. He's very sudden, gets up to full speed really quickly, and I think it's just going to give the offense a ton of diversity when, you know, they trot out there for fall camp. And then even as the games get to going. And then Keontae Ingram is another guy that, you know, I was really high on as a true freshman. Looks like he took the offseason program to heart, has put on some good muscle, but has still allowed him to retain his explosiveness. And so I was just really impressed by what he was able to do, again, between the tackles and making people miss and in, you know, the passing game. And so both he and Jordan Whittington looked to be a really effective 1-2 punch. I think, you know, Keontae will still be the starter, but, you know, we'll see a lot of Jordan Whittington pretty early and often, and probably even going to see them you know, on the field at the same time at points in time. And so I think that'll, you know, continue to help this offense evolve, allow Sam to be able to do some things from a hurry up perspective that don't really give the defense a whole lot of opportunity to sub out, but then can still give, you know, a myriad of looks, whether it's lining up, you know, and just snapping the ball in a particular formation, or with both or either of the guys in the backfield and then motioning out to different spots that would be reserved typically for a receiver. So I really was impressed by the running game and what they're doing in the way of the running backs. And, you know, I think all in all, when it's all said and done, I think we'll be looking at that position as an upgrade for this 2019 season, provided that, you know, obviously they can both stay healthy. The other guy, you know, I mentioned Malcolm Epps. It seemed like both of the scrimmages that I went to, he was just being targeted a great deal, and he was making, you know, the best of those targets. I mean, he is a huge individual, and so he was really just filling in, you know, right where Colin, you know, otherwise would have been. And I think he did everything he could to take the advantage of those reps. I'll be interested to see, you know, come fall camp, where they start to position him on the field, and then when it becomes, you know, time for game planning, where he actually ends up. At the very least, I think he gives us another red zone threat, and then, you know, gives us just, you know, the ability to have another big body out there. But he was the receiver that impressed me the most throughout the spring practices. And then flipping back to the defensive side of the ball, you had your guys like Keandre Coburn, Malcolm Roach, Jeffrey McCulloch, Joseph Asai, Chris Brown, and then Jalen Green and Deshaun Jameson. And so I'll kind of run through them real quick. Keandre Coburn was big. You know, like I said, he was out for the early part of the practices with, you know, some injury concerns, but ultimately he came on really strong. I saw him make, you know, a number of stops in short yardage instances, and he was just overall very disruptive. And so that was good to see from a young guy that hadn't played a whole lot of time, or hadn't had a whole lot of game reps. But, you know, from the reps that I saw in the spring, he does look like he's ready to take that next step. And that's something the defense will certainly need. Malcolm Roach, I think he just showed, you know, what people are expecting out of him as a senior leader. You could tell he's certainly taking on much more of a vocal role Same applies for Jeffrey McCullough. You know, notice that both of them were not only making plays. I think McCullough had, you know, a couple of interceptions from what I saw. And then I believe even in the spring game had one, making plays and kind of living up to what you thought they would grow into, you know, up until this coming season, effectively up until this offseason, they've always kind of been able to defer to the older guys that were before them, that were, you know, I guess more of the starters, more of the stars, more of the vocal leaders. And so they've had to start growing that voice. And I think their continued development in those areas are going to be key to a defense that loses a lot of starters. But, you know, they're two guys that have played a number of downs for Texas. And then, like I said, Joseph Asai is just a guy that I think everybody kind of sees a star in the making. Every time I looked up in practice, he was making plays. He was very vocal and had a bit of a swagger and confidence to himself. And so I think that was really big. And then same can be said for a guy like Chris Brown. Again, he made some had some practices where he was out. But anytime he was in there, you know, he was making an impact from the safety position. You know, they could drop him down, you know, into the slot as needed. And, you know, just seemed to have made some really good strides. And I think will be an integral piece of the defense. Be interested, again, to see how they work everybody in. And then I think the final two, and I'll even throw in one more that wasn't on this list, but Jalen Green and Deshaun Jameson, I almost kind of count as one with them both playing the corner spots. From all the practices I saw, those two were manning the starting positions. You know, like I mentioned, Anthony Cook was out. But I think if the season were to start today, Jalen Green and Deshaun Jameson would be your starters. And I think they would be formidable. You know, I think I certainly don't look at them as a true downgrade, where Deshaun Jameson, you know, somewhat lacks in vertical height. I think he makes up for a lot of that with his heart and just his tenacious play. Saw him come up several times and make plays in the backfield. So he's certainly not afraid to, you know, stick his nose in there. And then Jalen Green is just, I mean, he's literally just your prototypical cornerback. Like if you were to build a cornerback, you would want him to look like Jalen Green. And he showed throughout the spring some of the promise that I think people have been looking to him, you know, to have. And so, you know, really when it gets down to it, I think what they lack in experience, they, you know, more than make up for in ability. And as the season goes on, will become a strength. And then the final guy, you know, like I said, wasn't on the list that I saw 24/7 Sports put out, but was certainly a guy that I paid attention to a lot, was DeMarvion Overshown. And, you know, when you see him out there, it sounds cliche and everybody says it, but he really is like a heat-seeking missile out there. You know, really big safety, likes to come up and hit you. And, you know, I'm sure he's wanting to hang on to, you know, that thought of playing safety. But I think the quickest way he can get on the field and make an impact is kind of from the linebacker position or linebacker depth. So if you don't want to call him a linebacker, fine. But I think, you know, the defense and Coach Orlando would certainly be able to benefit from having him on the field at different times, especially, you know, if we maybe go into a dime package or something like that, where you're getting more defensive backs on the field, it would be good to have a guy like him in there. And so it'll be really interesting to see, you know, again, when everybody's healthy, what the coaches choose to do in deploying guys like him and Chris Brown, because there's only so many spots. And you know that, you know, Brandon Jones Brandon Jones and Caden Stearns are likely to man a couple of those spots. And then I didn't mention BJ Foster, but he had an exceptional spring as well. So, you know, guys like that, man, I mean, again, it's like talent for days at the defensive back positions, particularly at the safety position, as well as wide receivers. So, you know, there's plenty of talent that is present. And it's just a matter of them, you know, putting it together and seeing where that talent goes. So, you know, that's kind of my thoughts on spring ball. I think the guys are making a right step forward. It'll be important for them, you know, to stay healthy, stay out of trouble over these, you know, coming summer months. And that's some time that you know, really do a lot of building with your teammates and, you know, where the remaining freshmen that'll be coming in will start to report probably in early June. And so that's really where, you know, I think we always built our teams was in the summer, where you're kind of not as guided by your coaches. And it just kind of comes down to how bad you want it and you coming together with your teammates, with your brothers, and just kind of building bonds that ultimately last, you know, right into the season. So hopefully these guys take advantage of that. I'll be looking forward to it. I'll keep, you know, my ear to the ground for anything that I'm able to, you know, ascertain from rumblings. But more than that, probably no news is good news. I think maybe the next thing that we're really looking forward to hearing is whether or not Brew McCoy's waiver was approved by the NCAA for him to be able to play right away in the fall. And we'll just kind of go from there. So, you know, we'll certainly keep you posted on any updates with respect to the team as they come around. So that's kind of it there. Now, I think it's a good time for us to shift over to discussion of the 2019 draft. Now, every year, a number of guys, you know, obviously go through the draft prep process. A number of guys go and you know, choose to put their name in the hat early and come out as juniors. And at any given time, there's varying degrees of success with that, right? And I think, you know, during my time that I was playing during those, you know, early 2000s, we had a lot of success in the NFL drafts, a lot of high draft picks, something we had kind of become known for. We had begun to, you know, kind of shake some of the stigmas of, you know, Texas players being considered soft. And so you had any number of guys, you know, from both the offensive and defensive lines, linebackers, defensive backs, you name it, you know, guys getting drafted and drafted really high and going out and performing really well in the NFL. And then, you know, we kind of hit this rut where for a number of years, we just weren't having as much success with guys being drafted. And, you know, I think we're kind of, I won't go as far to say all time low, but, you know, maybe a modern low, that Texas is not seeing the development of its players resulting in NFL evaluators, NFL front office types, NFL scouts believing enough in them to draft them at a high clip. And then, you know, even beyond that at a, you know, as high picks. And so I think the guy that in this draft was expected to, you know, probably go highest early on in the process. There were some mock drafts that were, you know, pointing him as maybe a late first rounder. But generally speaking, most people didn't, you know, expect him to last past the second or third round. And that was Charles Omenihu. And ultimately, he slid all the way to the fifth round. So he was the 161st pick overall. The Houston Texans selected him. And so, you know, you guys aren't stupid. 161 overall means 160 players were evaluated by the NFL as better fits for their organizations than Charles was. And that's, you know, pretty astonishing given that, you know, he was Defensive Player of the Year. And you would have thought that that would have resulted in, you know, maybe him being viewed a little bit differently. And so I think that's a couple things. I think maybe that's us as fans, you know, potentially overrating him some, as well as, at least in his instance, I think, you know, potentially some NFL organizations underrating him a little bit. You know, he has certainly the perfect frame for the position. Can continue to grow, can continue to develop. I think his landing spot is ideal for him, going to the Texans, having the ability to, you know, stay in state, and then learn from two of the best in the game and J.J. Watt and Jadeveon Clowney. I think will, you know, be exceptional for him. He won't have to be relied heavily upon right away, and it'll give him the opportunity to learn the game. But the discussion around it is more just so that, you know, here's another guy that I think most expected to go, you know, much higher than he did, and he didn't. When we get down to it, 17 players from the Big 12 were drafted before Charles Omenihu, of which two were defensive linemen / linebackers from TCU. And those two players were selected in the first and second rounds, respectively. So, you know, again, you have this dichotomy of, and I was having a conversation in a group chat with some guys about this, particularly one that's like a diehard TCU fan, right? And he had basically said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, two defensive players from TCU selected in the first and second rounds. And meanwhile, Charles Omenihu is the defensive player of the year in the Big 12, shaking my head. And so my point to him was kind of twofold. One, I don't think necessarily the fact that Charles was drafted where he is an indictment against what his 2018 impact was in the Big 12. When it gets down to it, Big 12 coaches that faced both Charles Omenihu and the two players that were selected from TCU felt like, at least in the way of their voting on the player of the year, felt like Charles was someone that required, I guess, maybe more attention of the offense than the other two guys. Another thing that I tried to kind of point out to him is, hey, Charles was kind of like it on our defensive line. Like, he was our pass rush. And so more times than not, he experienced, you know, a number of double and sometimes even triple teams where you have a back or a tight end kind of chipping on him, and was still able to lead the league in sacks with 9.5, did really well from a tackle for loss perspective. And so, you know, that has to also be factored in. You can't just go strictly to the stats. And then, you know, with TCU having at least two, you know, pretty standout guys, you know, in that way they had, you know, the two of them were each other's running mates, so to speak. So one was able to command the attention of the offense versus the other. And then that makes, you know, for a few more one-on-one matchups. So I don't necessarily think that just because those two guys were selected before Charles means that he wasn't deserving of the award. What I do think it signals is that the NFL looks at both of those players as more versatile than Charles, whereas Charles was maybe still kind of viewed as a bit of a project and someone that needed to fit within the confines of a specific scheme. So, you know, that's kind of my general thoughts there. Then you had Chris Boyd was selected in the, I had this in front of me, selected in the 7th round by the Minnesota Vikings, a team that's familiar with, you know, corners from Texas. They've had Cedric Griffin in the past. They signed Holton Hill last year as an undrafted free agent. So this kind of reunites the two of them, although Holton's serving a suspension earlier, but early in the 2019 season. But hopefully he, you know, has learned from that and matures. But it's kind of cool to see the two of them back there. You know, you had Brian Robinson just recently retire. So he was actually the last one from my 2002 recruiting class to retire from the NFL. But I say all that to say they've have some familiarity with Texas players. And so, you know, Chris Boyd may have an opportunity to go in there, make an impact on special teams. But again, you know, just a guy that has the perfect build for the cornerback position, but maybe his collegiate production just didn't lead to that. But that's it. Those are the two guys that got drafted from Texas. And so, you know, it's somewhat, I guess, disheartening, if you will, just because ultimately, there were only 26 players drafted from the Big 12. And of those 26, only two of them were from Texas. You had 8 guys from Oklahoma get drafted. There were 5 guys from West Virginia got drafted. And then TCU had 3. And both Iowa State, Kansas State, Oklahoma State, and Texas all had 2 each. And so, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I don't really know how else to put it, you know, because we're always compared to them. A&M was in the top 5. They had 7 guys drafted. And then you look at, you know, the perennial stalwarts in Alabama and Ohio State. They had 10 and 9 guys drafted, respectively. A Georgia team that Texas, you know, dominated in the Sugar Bowl had 7 guys drafted. Clemson had 6 guys drafted. And so you just kind of start looking across the country and all these different programs had more guys drafted than Texas. And then I don't say this to be disparaging, but at the end of the day, these next programs that I'm going to list off are by no means considered, you know, traditional blue bloods of college football or powerhouses or anything like that. But they all had more guys drafted than Texas. Utah had 5 guys drafted. NC State, 4 guys drafted. Boston College, 4 guys. Maryland, 4 guys now. Of course, we know, as Texas fans, unfortunately, that Maryland has plenty of talent. But more times than not, Maryland shouldn't be having more guys drafted than Texas, right? And so that's where you kind of get into this, okay, well, you know, you Texas fans always think that, you know, y'all are, you know, high and mighty, so to speak. But at the end of the day, if you're wanting to be one of these upper echelon programs, you should be having a significant number of your guys being viewed as hot commodities by the NFL. And, you know, so that's just, you know, it's just something to kind of keep your eye on. Now, with all that being said, I didn't get into all the details of this, but I would say it does look good upon Tom Herman for some of the guys that they have taken on since they've come to this program, as well as some of the guys that they, you know, I think should get some partial credit for their time at both the University of Houston with a guy like Ed Oliver, or even at the time at Ohio State with a guy like Dwayne Haskins being drafted. Yeah, I don't think you should give them all the credit, but, you know, they're guys that they identified, recruited, had some success in their program with. And, you know, so I think I'm saying this to say that there should be better times to come for the Texas program. But the current state of affairs is one that has us having way more undrafted free agents than we do, you know, guys that were actually drafted. And that's something that just has to change, you know. And so when you look at the list of undrafted free agents, there's a number of guys that landed in some spots that I think are pretty good spots for them and should give them an opportunity to, maybe thrive if, you know, things work their way and if they're able to work hard for it. But I would say the two guys that, you know, maybe are the let me put it like this. Gary Johnson is the guy that I think of the Texas guys that didn't get drafted, I was most shocked by. Some would say Lil Jordan Humphrey, but I think we saw, you know, with his, draft prep, if you will, and what that experience was like for him, that it was pretty likely that he may go undrafted. And so, you know, there's plenty of people that will rush to say, he shouldn't have gone pro, but, you know, I'm not about to bag on a guy for that. You know, he could have been making that decision for any number of reasons. What I will say is I think it's obvious in retrospect that he should have done a much better job in his preparation. And so it's my hope that he does that, you know, in his time going forward so that he can make the roster. But I think we all know he's a good ball player. And so if he can get, you know, maybe some of those, I guess we could say, work ethic and or judgment, you know, decisions that he's made in the pre-draft process, you know, kind of ironed out, he has the ability to, you know, be really successful. But Gary Johnson, he signed with the Chiefs as an undrafted free agent. Lil Jordan Humphrey signed with the Saints. Both, I think, are pretty good landing spots for both of them. Lil Jordan Humphrey, you know, I think the Saints in the past have shown the ability to draft and utilize big wide receivers. I think one of the guys in my group chat pointed out that they signed Marcus Colston pretty late in the draft, and he went on to have a very good career for them. And then a guy like Gary Johnson, you know, I think the Chiefs defense has experienced a lot of turnover. He certainly is a guy that will make, I think, a big impact on their special teams. And I think he has a very good shot at making the team there. And so I think that was a good landing spot for him. Defensive tackle or nose tackle Chris Nelson was signed by the Steelers. Again, an organization that has had some familiarity with Texas players. Calvin Anderson and Andrew Beck both signed with the Patriots. You know, if the Patriots are giving you an opportunity, you know, their track record for late round picks, undrafted free agents. And so, you know, both guys should have an opportunity to learn from some of the best in the game and be able to potentially perform there. You had Devontae Davis, the cornerback, go to the Seahawks as an undrafted free agent. Sticking on the secondary side of the ball, PJ Locke, also signed by the Steelers. So always kind of cool to see, you know, guys get to go along a journey with some of the guys they played with in college. And then Brecken Hager, was signed by the New York Giants. So, you know, some of them have a little tougher road to hoe than the others. But I think at the end of the day, they all have an opportunity to make their impact on the league. And so I'm certainly hoping the best for them. And then you had a couple few guys receive rookie camp tryouts. Anthony Wheeler was invited to try out with the Cardinals. Patrick Vahe received a tryout with the Ravens. And then Elijah Rodriguez received a tryout with the Saints. Haven't been able to confirm anything in the way of who Trey Watson is signed with. And then I read some reports of Gerard Hurd being offered to the CFL and that he may be leaning that direction, but I don't have any way to qualify that. But at the end of the day, you know, like I said, the biggest, I think, kind of looming cloud, so to speak, and it will certainly be used against Texas in the throngs of the recruiting trails is that we just haven't been getting a lot of guys drafted and certainly not guys drafted at a high clip. I saw a tweet the other day that said for the first time in what is considered like the history of the common draft, Texas has not had a first round pick in four straight drafts. And so, I mean, that's pretty amazing when you think about the fact that other schools in the state of Texas that are generally deemed as smaller, except for, you know, I guess when you talk about A&M, but they're not the flagship school of the state, have all had first round picks in the last 3 years. Those schools include Baylor, Houston, TCU, Texas A&M, Texas Tech, and UTSA. So they've all had a first round pick in the last 3 years, and Texas has not. So that's certainly something that has to change. I think, you know, with some of this crop coming in the next couple of years, that's something that will change. But certainly it's something that, you know, these coaches, particularly coaches, you know, that are usually recruiting against us from the SEC because they're often, you know, coming after Texas guys, will use against us. And when you look at the breakdown by conference, the SEC, you know, once again, by and away dominated the number of draft picks. They had 64, followed by the Big Ten had 40. The Pac-12 had 33. The ACC had 28. And coming in fifth was the Big 12 with 26. So I think that's just something to continue to kind of monitor, something to kind of keep in mind. I mean, hell, OU has had the number one overall pick in their quarterback with Kyler Murray being selected this year and then Baker Mayfield being selected last year. So, you know, there's certainly some ammo for people to be able to use on the recruiting trails. That's just one piece of the equation, of course. But your elite of elite guys are looking at what is going to be able to, you know, help me get to the next level. And so that'll be something they pay attention to. That'll be something that people use to recruit against us. I am a firm believer of winning solves everything. So if Texas continues to win at a high clip, you continue to have elite guys wanting to come play for the program. Those guys get developed better, which it does seem, you know, Coach Herman and Yancey McKnight have had a way and the rest of the staff have had a way of doing with their players at every stop they've made. But the more and more those things happen, then that ultimately results in more guys getting drafted. So that's kind of my look at the 2019 draft. And we have talked for 38 minutes already. So, you know, I probably won't get into too much depth when it comes to Avengers Endgame and Game of Thrones, but I am going to kind of give some general thoughts, impressions, just kind of how I responded to, you know, getting to see, you know, what I've seen from both of those to this point. So with that, if you have not seen either of those, if you're holding off, I would encourage you at this point to go ahead and stop listening to this episode. Please tune back in. I appreciate you listening to this point. Please give me feedback on anything you've heard, anything you'd like me to talk some more about. You can reach me on all my social media at Marcus Myers. But this needs to be the off ramp for anybody that doesn't want any spoilers to Avengers Endgame or Game of Thrones. So I'll give you 3, 2, 1, and spoiler time, right? So like I said earlier, been following the Marvel universe, if you will. They call it what phase? We're up through almost through the end of phase 3 once the new Spider-Man movie comes out this summer. But Avengers Endgame, I mean, man, it was just like it was an experience. You know, I think it was a full 3 hour runtime. I've had a rough last couple of weeks. Hadn't been feeling the greatest physically, mentally, and even emotionally, just been kind of drained. Work's been kicking my butt. But this was something important for me to, you know, check out. Like I said, it's a full 3 hour runtime. That's not even including the previews. And so I saw an episode at 10:50 p.m. on last Thursday night, you know, the earliest that I could find a showing. By the time I had gone to get tickets, I wanted to go see it at IPIC so I could be reclined and everything. And by the time I went to get tickets, the 10:50 showing was all that there was. But, I thought they did a pretty good job, man, of just like wrapping up a lot of, you know, the different story, you know, lines and tying things in together. I mean, of course, there were some things that, you know, like I took issue with. But, all in all, I think, you know, they did a good job of weaving, you know, years and years of storylines together. And I'm excited to see where things will go next. I did kind of have a problem with like Captain America being able to like use Thor's hammer and like command electricity somewhat. Like that was kind of weird to me. And I'm not a big staunch follower in the way of like having read all the comic books. So I don't know if that's something that took place there, but I didn't really care for that in the film. It took Thor like a significant amount of time. I was talking to my brother about this the other day. It took Thor like a good amount of time just to figure out how to use that shit. So it was kind of odd that Captain America could do it. And I understood that, you know, they kind of had to send him out with a bang and, same for Iron Man. But that was, you know, kind of one portion that I think, you know, if I had to nitpick on that, you know, I wasn't all the way, you know, down with. But other than that, man, I didn't really have too many complaints with the movie. It was just, there was a number of enjoyable, episodes. And of course, you know, that final battle where, you know, it kind of looks like Thanos is, you know, about to win and, you know, has all of his minions starting to descend upon him. And then everybody comes back. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was one of those things where, like, I wanted to shout out in the theater, but I've never really been that type. So I didn't. But like when I, you know, you saw, the Black Panther characters come through the portal and then, you know, Doctor Strange comes through and then just everybody else, just starts coming back to attack, man. Like that, I don't know, man. That was just like, it just felt very rewarding, you know, and the way that, you know, they went and attacked Thanos and then ultimately killed him and, just to kind of see where the story arc is going, was cool. And then, you know, even Captain America ultimately kind of, you know, sacrificing himself, for what he knew was the betterment of all of mankind was neat to see. So, you know, some people get really emotional and stuff like that. For whatever reason, I didn't, but I was always connected. You know, Captain America was always one of my favorite characters. And so it'll suck to not see him in the future movies, but you never know how they're going to go with this. You know, they may do some prequel stuff or, you know, there's all different kind of ways that they can go with the series, you know, as it enters into like, I guess, phase four or whatever that is. So, something I'll certainly be taking, you know, a look at and keeping an eye on. But, I was really glad to see it, really enjoyed, watching it. May talk a little bit more in depth about it at some point, you know, because I plan on seeing it again, just so I can pick up on any parts that I missed. But definitely enjoyed it. Think it was a good way to kind of start to put a bow tie on that series of characters. So I really enjoyed that. Now, Game of Thrones. Everything has been building up to this, right? Like we've always been hearing about the White Walkers and, you know, this big battle coming with the Night King. And it just seems like, you know, since season one, there's been hints at like this is the big battle looming. Winter is coming, and winter's finally here. You know, we've spent the first two episodes, you know, kind of tying off on some of the character arcs and backstories and people being reunited and things like that. And we finally, you know, got, I guess, what was considered like the big payoff in this third episode with the Battle of Winterfell. And I think the Battle of the Bastards, it took them 25 nights to film it. The same director that filmed that episode filmed was behind this episode with the Battle of Winterfell. It took 25 nights to film Battle of the Bastards. It took 55 nights to film this battle. So the hype was at an all-time high. And I kind of have mixed feelings, you know. So going into the episode, and I have this, you know, documented in text messages, with my brother and it just, I don't know. I did my best to kind of try to make predictions of who I thought was going to die in this episode. And so who I ultimately predicted in dying this episode were Brienne, Theon, I call him Fire Sword Guy. I don't remember his name. The short Night's Watch guy that first started out with Sam and Jon. I had tussled with thinking Grey Worm would die because, you know, he was, you know, talking about taking Missandei to the beach and that kind of thing. But then I decided at the last minute, like, okay, nah, they'll probably kill off Missandei to really, like, piss us off and get at Grey Worm. And then I also was pretty sure that Lady Mormont was going to die and that Jorah was going to die. But everybody else I kind of figured, like, needed to live because they still needed to get to Cersei. Like, I was pretty confident that they were going to beat the Night King. And so ultimately, when it all shook out, the only ones of the people that I predicted were going to die that didn't were Brienne and Missandei. Everybody else that I thought was going to die died, and no other, you know, major characters did. But the first thing that kind of, I think, annoyed me about the episode was, like, it was dark as hell. And I think, I'm pretty sure that they intended to do that, but, like, I saw a tweet, you know, that basically said something to the effect of, like, you know, you're in this world of, like, magical dragons and, you know, mythical creatures and, you know, just all this stuff. Like, let us see what's going on, you know? Like, and so it was so dark to the point where, like, I was kind of, you know, I always talk about group chats I'm in. Me and a big group of fellas have a Game of Thrones group chat where we, you know, we're constantly talking about the show. And so this morning we were all kind of chatting about it. And we were all just talking about how, like, when we were watching it, we thought something was wrong with our TVs. Like, that's how bad the visibility was. And so from that perspective, like, during the battle, it didn't really heighten my sense of anxiety or what was going to take place. It kind of annoyed me more than anything. And so I felt like that was an area that they could have done a better job in. That being said, the part where the Dothraki were, like, you know, running off into the darkness, you know, swords on fire and, you know, the greatest thing, you know, on horseback and these, you know, great fighters, like, that was some serious anxiety going there. Like, I didn't know what was about to happen. And then Jorah comes riding back and he's, like, not moving. Thought that he was either already turned and or I thought, you know how sometimes those scenes in movies happen or TV shows happen where, like, somebody has, like, gotten their head or a limb, something chopped off, but it takes a minute for it to, like, slide off their body. Like, I thought maybe that was the case. But then, like, he just comes trotting back and he, like, doesn't say anything. So that kind of threw me off. But all in all, like, it was a pretty gratifying battle scene. Obviously, my girl Arya, you know, came through in the end. I could nitpick at, like, how the hell did she slide by, like, the White Walkers, but I can give her that, you know, maybe she had some training and that kind of thing. But there were some things that I just felt like they kind of just threw together, you know, like, how the hell is Theon stopping, like, all these whites and White Walkers that, you know, can run like a 4-3 and can go through any and everything. And at the end of the day, like, these dudes are, like, taking them out with arrows. Like, I don't know. It just seemed, some aspects of it seemed rushed, but I also get that, like, the showrunners only have so much that they can do and so much time. And ultimately, we're trying to cram, you know, the culmination of some of this into the final 6 episodes. And so all in all, I was pleased. I was entertained. I felt like there was opportunities for them to have done a little bit more. I was telling somebody one of those areas was in the crypt, right? Like, you have all these dead Starks. So one of my theories was maybe the Starks were going to come to life somehow and then fight against the dead. But if that weren't the case, and if it was really how it ended up happening, they came alive and were fighting for the Night King, what I thought would have been a bigger payoff is if, like, you had, you know, Sansa face to face with her mother or something, and she has to, like, kill her mother to survive, or, you know, something like that. Just some things I think that would have maybe tugged at our heartstrings a little bit more. By and large, at the end of the day, like, nobody truly, like, important died. You know, all of our main characters are still intact. Arya, you know, has kind of seen the culmination of her training come into play. The Hound, you know, he had to like snap out of his funk and fear of the fire and the tendency to be selfish because he saw Arya getting, you know, busy and knew that like he had to, you know, really snap too. And so that, you know, continued, like made me respect him because of how much he cuts for Arya. But at the end of the day, man, like I'm still not sure how some of this stuff is going to play out. You know, there's part of me that thinks like, I was thinking that like maybe somehow Arya is the one that's going to kill Cersei. But I think really what's going to be more fitting for that is that Jaime is the one that has to kill Cersei. A friend of ours in that group chat put together like a survey, and I think I picked Sansa to sit on the Iron Throne, which I'm not really, I don't know how confident I am in that, but that was my pick. And I did pick Arya to kill the Night King. So I felt good about that prediction. But man, like it was just an intense episode. It was like years of everything we've been watching, you know, were coming to a head. And at the end of the day, like when it was all said and done, I felt exhausted. Like I felt like I was a part of the battle. And so to that end, I think, you know, the writers and the showrunners did an amazing job of having you immersed in it. It was intense. It, you know, I think it kept you on the edge of your seat and captivated. And so while there was areas, you know, obviously that I was nitpicking, you know, in what I was just discussing, all in all, I was really happy about it. I actually watched the episode with my dad, who he's only watched this episode and the episode prior of Game of Thrones. So in a lot of ways, he didn't have any idea what was going on. But I told him beforehand, I said, man, look, you can't ask me questions during this. Like, you got to let me have this. And so he did that. He actually fell asleep for a little bit, not because it was boring or anything, but just because my pops always falls asleep. But he woke up, you know, towards the end, and like he was laughing at me because I was shouting when Arya killed the Night King. You know, like I was yelling like in jubilation, like I would if Texas has just scored a touchdown. Or something like that. So, I mean, it was that kind of a feel for me. You know, now you got to see who's left, who is there to regroup, what's the plan for trying to deal with Cersei, because, you know, she has the Golden Company. And so these next three episodes, man, are going to be interesting. I think this next episode is going to be more of the regrouping and kind of taking a step back from all the action. I believe I read the same director for this episode is going to be directing episode 5. So that's what leads me to believe that that's going to be the next big battle we have. And then maybe episode 6 kind of wraps everything up. So I'll be looking forward to seeing, you know, where it goes from here. And probably we'll use these next few weeks to, you know, kind of give recaps of that. Another show that I'm really into is The Chi. May talk some about that, as well as Billions. Both of those are on Showtime. Love both of those shows. But like I said, because of Game of Thrones, because of Endgame, because of life, I'm not up to date on the most recent episodes of each of those shows. So I'll probably watch those in the next couple of days. But that's going to do it, man. I think this maybe is my longest episode, or if not longest, second longest. So for those of you that have stuck with me this far, I appreciate it. Thank you. I will put in the show notes, I think, where, you know, we talked about Avengers Endgame and Game of Thrones, so that if you're telling your friends about it, they know, you know, hey, around this mark, you know, look out for the spoilers to come for those shows. But again, thank you for sticking with me, man. Thank you for your time. You could certainly be doing anything else with it. So the fact that you're listening to, you know, a guy that just likes sports and movies and TV and that kind of thing talk, you know, means the world to me. Certainly have plans on doing some, you know, fun things with the podcast here in the off season. So be on the lookout for that. As always, you know, welcome any and all feedback. That's how I know, you know, if what I'm doing is working or if what I'm doing isn't. So until the next episode, you know, I hope you guys, you know, are able to have good weeks, productive weeks, or you know, able to enjoy, you know, some time with your families. Just kind of step back from life every now and then and just appreciate what's around you, because I know I'm guilty of getting caught up in the hustle and bustle of things and always trying to achieve maybe whatever the next goal is and just not appreciating where you are in the moment. So that's your little word of wisdom from Marcus on this one. Again, I'm your host, Marcus Myers. This has been episode number 23 of the Until the Whistle podcast. and we will catch you the next time the whistle blows.